I'll help Jeff field questions. We've got two mics, and I've got a list of questions, but want to hear your questions. So I'll just alternate between one microphone and the other microphone and take people as they line up and are interested in asking some questions. One that came to my mind, and I'm trying to get a handle on port access. You've got rules in place. You say that's going to be deregulated, go to a commercial system. But it sounds like it's not working that well if you've got other interests looking at doing their own port facilities. It sounds like they're just not all that happy with working through somebody else's port.
It's more of a big stick than anything else. And we will pull the big stick out if the current port providers don't work with us and give us good access to those particular ports. The other thing that you need to consider is that there is, once the port access arrangements are withdrawn in 2014, you will still have the competition the Australian Consumer and Competition Commission will still be operating that the legislation which will ensure that people who want to export through those ports will have access to those. And I use the analogy there of the airports is a really good example of that. So we're expecting that by 2014, the commercial processes would have aligned themselves well and better, and they are getting better every year, as I say, and then it will just become just totally deregulated, but we'll still have the legislation in behind it if required.
Now, you mentioned that you've had a number of marketing co-ops been established and a number of them very successful. Are they operating without any facilities? Or are they operating with inland facilities or export facilities? Or what's the situation
there? Good question. Graves have stumped up and actually put in their own facilities. Some of them have bought existing facilities, but a lot of them have put in brand new facilities. And so they would have put in some millions of dollars worth of very, very good sealed storages, etc. And some of them have put in the container handling facilities as well. But the other thing what they have then done is they've also aligned themselves to a trading organisation to make sure that they get the marketing side and the management of price and managing counterparty risk, and then the logistics of getting the product out of Australia in place as well.
Question on mic two, Bob.
Do these marketing companies operate offshore milling and processing facilities in other countries?
Certainly CBH. It's a good question. CBH has a major investment, a 50% interest in one of the major Bogotari, one of the major flour mills in Indonesia, and that's CBH from Western Australia. So they have a major investment in Indonesia. Just sort of thinking through, the other Australian companies tend to be GrainCorp. They have interests. They don't have interests, interestingly, they don't have interests internationally in wheat processing. They certainly have it in barley processing in Europe, but they have very, very big interests in the domestic market for flour milling. And, of course, and that pretty well sort of rounds it out. So, yes, some of them do, but the principal one would be CBH. And once again, four marks to CBH, and I sort of underline the issue that it's still very much a grower co-op.
Doyle?
A very successful grower co-op.
Thanks. Just want to clarify a couple of things that I thought I heard you maybe say, but you know, you had to skip over things very quickly. In regard to contracts farmers are signing, are there a generic contract across the industry, and has that evolved, or is that legislated?
No, nothing's legislated. And we do our best to make sure that the heavy hand of government doesn't come anywhere near the grains industry, the commercial processes of the Australian grains industry. And that's why we put a lot of work into these sorts of issues. To answer the question specifically, we put out, particularly, say, with a grower contract, we have a grower contract that we put out, and I would say that the vast majority of contracts that are done between the trade and growers would be utilising that contract. There might be some minor variations to it that would take into account regional variations or variations between commodities specific, but in the main, they all have the same terms and conditions. And for instance, anybody doing a contract in Australia, we just have one force majeure clause. So there's a common understanding of what force majeure is, to give an example. But that doesn't mean that companies can't pick a contract up, or an individual grower can't pick a contract up, and by agreement with the other party, of course, make an amendment to it. But certainly it's not legislated.
Just further to the contracts, you talked about how, an example, this last year or 2 years ago with all the feed grade, how the discount for feed, you know, went crazy.
Yep.
And yet where some contracts had been signed with a particular basis there. Are most contracts that are signed for future delivery, does the grower either have a choice, or is there already those kind of quality spreads built into the contracts, and he chooses then whether to sign just the base price or with also those spreads?
The multi-grade contract is a contract that's been around, and it came out of the deregulation of the domestic market back in, when was it? I had to look on the slide again. It was 90. And so over the last 20 years, those multi-grade contracts have developed. And so you have a base price, and then you have a premium, and then a discount schedule. And that's agreed at the time of contract, at the time the contract is written.
There are a number of companies that have signed new crop contracts for wheat and durum in Canada and are able to do that after August 1st in the new crop year, and they've been out contracting. I haven't looked at them, but I've been told that they have a price established for a base grade, number one, 13.5% protein, no discounts, or the discount is at buyer discretion, or we'll figure out the discount if that problem arises. And there's a lot of growers that I've talked to are not very happy signing something where the discount is not defined. Now, you're not here to comment on the Canadian situation, but can you comment on a contract of that nature?
No, I can't.
Would you sign that?
I'll run the arbitration process. I can't give advice. No.
Do you ever see contracts like that without discounts defined in Australia?
No, not a multi-grade contract. There's multi-grade contracts for wheat, and there's also multi-grade contracts for barley. And obviously, you know, in particular areas, growers will go into a multi-grade for barley with the intention of delivering malt barley. But then if the season's particularly good or whatever, and they can only, you know, and it falls outside the malt parameters, well, what are the discounts in place between malt and feed? So it's not just a wheat thing. It's quite an established practice.
So those are, what you're saying is those are delineated in the contract at time of signing?
Correct. So if the contract's, you know, if the contract's a December delivery and it's written in August, they're agreed in August.
Now, if I've disparaged any of the grain companies that are offering new crop contracts for wheat and durum, I'm sure somebody will stand up and tell me. Microphone over here.
Yeah, just a question about the price discovery. To my understanding, that the Australians use the American currency or the American exchanges. Like the Chicago futures.
Okay, good question. Up until the deregulation of the export market in particular, we're very, very heavily focused on Chicago in particular, a bit out of Minneapolis, but heavy focus on Chicago. So we had to take into account obviously futures and FX, and then put in a local basis as well. But what has since transpired is the Australian Stock Exchange has introduced a wheat contract, a barley and a sorghum, but principally the wheat contract is the one that's getting attention, and that's getting pretty good support. It's still, you know, you wouldn't say it's as good in terms of a liquid market. You still could have situations where you could get caught in terms of if you want to get in or get out. But there is strong support and recognition within the Australian grains industry that it's a good thing to have.
So do you see that evolving, and that's going to be the trade of Australian farmers, or is it still going to be based on the US system?
I think probably see more of the it's all about sort of earning your stripes, I guess, and some sort of credibility and getting some runs on the ground. But I would expect that you'll see that more and more hedging is done within Australia, because obviously if you can do it within Australia, you don't have to worry about the FX component. So I would see that there will be a growth on that. But having said that, people will still do the Chicago, particularly for large volumes, because of traders, because it's very, very hard to get set for, you know, 40 or 50,000 tonnes overnight on the Australian exchange. You can do it on Chicago.
Thanks.
Right.
grab a microphone and feel free to ask a question. When we've exhausted questions or as we approach 9 o'clock, whichever comes first, we roll that big door back and open it up for some snacks and cash bar in case you haven't been to a special session before. Barry.
Yeah, did I understand from one of your slides that that there's more storage capacity in each one of the states than there is grain produced in those states?
Yeah.
So they don't even manage one turn in those facilities?
Oh, yeah, actually, yeah, good point. This is quite different to the Canadian situation where, you know, you might get 6 or 7 or 8 turns, I don't know what the number is, within your elevations. The Australian situation is one. It goes in, and then it goes to the export port, and that's it. So you don't have a situation where grain is coming in and then matching up with a train coming through, and then each month it's a case of one turn. I think that was a bit of an eye opener to Viterra, to have to come in against that sort of situation.
It's quite an eye opener to me. It doesn't look like a very efficient way of doing business. I thought Australian business was much more savvy than that.
Well, what came out of this? You go back, and it's the establishment by the various bulk handling, the original bulk handling facilities were all built by the states, and instead of growers having their own individual storages, it was just built. Okay, we'll build storages, and the original storages, forgotten what the number was, but they were built to satisfy steam trains, and so every time how far you could go without having to get water again, and so you go up these branch lines, and whether it's every 30 kilometres there was another silo that was built. Some of them might only take a couple of thousand tonnes. Well, all of those are gone, and the sites that are left now are those sorts of sites that, and actually, I don't know if I can show it to you. No.
Yeah, keep going, guys.
Yes. No. That's
this might slide. Be a ways back.
There's slides I didn't use, but there was a site. There was one particular site there that right up front, and it's actually a Viterra site in South Australia that had bunker. What is bunker storage? And that's the sort of storage that's put in now. It's not vertical elevation. It's on the ground and with a tarp over the top, and they can expand or contract that very, very cheaply.
So it's very low-cost storage compared to what we're used to in our high-throughput terminals is what
Correct.
You're saying.
Yeah.
But how do you can't put it in a bag or the bugs and everything gets into it. How the heck can you just throw it on a slab of concrete and put a tarp over it and have it survive?
Yeah, well, that's it works because they can do it and they can. And the sorts of the bunker storage is a little bit more sophisticated than just a slab with a tarp over the top. That does have sides, and they can gas them. So, from that aspect, it does work extremely well, and it's and cost effective. But in terms of on farm, one of the real issues, and it's a real bugbear, is that the handling the takeoff from the headers these days and those sort of facilities just far outstrip the ability of the central storage system to receive grain in. So that's why in a lot of farmers are now putting on-farm storage on so they can handle it on-farm and then get it into the system at a later time or market it themselves. And some of them have used those plastic sausage bags or silo bags, but they are really only short term.
I don't know what the average would be here in Saskatchewan, but I bet every grower probably has enough storage for one crop, maybe one and a half crops. I don't know. It'd be interesting to know the number. But it's a big investment here that Australian growers don't have, or don't have to that degree. It's a very interesting Correct. Difference. But, of course, you're also all your grain production is very close to port position. What's your average haul?
Yeah, 453. This isn't a Dorothy Dixer either, if you know what a Dorothy Dixer is. 453 kilometres.
Yeah.
That's the average haul for grain in Australia to a port, to its nearest port.
Some of our specialty crops move that far to get to a processing facility. Tim?
Thank you very much for your history lesson. There's many people sitting in these chairs here that have sat on and are currently sitting on commodity commissions. And the levy dollars that we collect from the farmers here, much of that goes into generic programs of market development, and that was one of the comments that you had said that you're now going into generic wheat promotion. Could you talk about who funds that and how you're going about that in Australia?
Yep. It's one of the things that AWB obviously did. They'd get along to trade shows and they'd be promoting Australian grain per se. And the real question is, well, who benefits from the generic promotion of Australian grain? It's a bit of a vexed question, but certainly the producers do. And I sort of made that point that don't automatically assume that all grain that goes out of Australia is specifically on the contracts, specifically saying that it has to be Australian grain. The vast majority of it is optional origin. It just so happens that the Australian grain can best meet those specifications and requirements in terms of whether it be the specifications and or price. So the generic promotion of Australian grain hasn't been picked up. Wheat Quality Australia was formed 12 months ago to look specifically at, and it was recognised that we needed to keep the varietal classification process going because things such as Australian Premium Hard, APH grain, it's a trade, it's a brand, it's well known. We need to protect it, and to be able to protect it, we need to have the correct varieties going into APH, and so we need that classification process to continue, and so that process is continuing. We picked the name Wheat Quality Australia so that we could broaden its focus. And as I was saying, the organisation attended its first trade show a couple of months ago, and it was there. And it wasn't promoting Australian grain per se, but it was promoting the processes that Wheat Quality Australia are now introducing or have introduced to protect the APH brand, etc. So if you are looking for wheat to produce a particular type of bakery item or whatever, and you know that APH satisfies that need as an end user, whether you're domestic or international, we want to give you comfort that that you can still buy wheat that is APH and still get those particular requirements. So it's an evolving thing, but you just can't come in. Some people say, well, why didn't you put that in place on day one? In some respects, it's probably a bad analogy, but you know, it's a bit like a drug addict. You know, you need to go down, recognise what needs to be picked up, and then pick up the pieces that need to be picked up. And so that's exactly what happened has happened, and I think I would think that if I was standing here in 2 years' time, I'll be giving a much different answer in relation to the generic promotion of Australian wheat.
Question over here.
That sort of makes sense.
Yeah, hi, Kevin. Yeah, you mentioned that who would sign a contract when you didn't know what the discounts are. Well, we sign contracts with canola all the time, and we don't know the discount from number one to number two. I signed a contract for $13.50 way back when. If it goes number two, if it would have, I have no idea what the discounts are, but we do it all the time. So I don't think it'll be a whole lot of difference with these contracts. Like Cargill's got out at 13 protein, and I think it's, what is it? Number two at 13 protein. So, you know, if you go number one, you'll get a plus, and if you go a little bit below your 13 protein, you'll get a discount. But I don't think it'll be a whole lot different than marketing our canola.
I guess you're quite right. Those discounts are not defined, but I would think that, and there's probably been times when the discount from a number one to a number two canola has been a sharp discount, but when you look at wheat and what can happen between going from a 113.5 to a number three or a feed, and what the market might say that discount is versus what somebody might charge you for a discount, I think I would be concerned. I'm concerned about wheat, or I'd be concerned about malting barley. I'd be concerned about malting barley not knowing what the price of feed would be if in the contract, but that was just my opinion.
Well, everybody's welcome to their opinion.
Yeah, it's worth that much, yeah.
Thanks, Kevin.
Yeah, you bet. Hubert.
On your export quality milling wheat, you didn't mention whether or not your nation cleans the grain before it's loaded onto a ship.
The answer is no.
The answer is no?
No.
Zero?
Zero. Grain is received into the upcountry sites, and there's a very, very strict set of specifications that it has to adhere to. If it adheres to those specifications on protein and screenings and small seeds and all of that, it's accepted and then it's exported as that. It's not cleaned again.
So what sort of dockage levels would your best quality wheats be going out at?
There's no dockage levels because it's either accepted into the system or it's not. If it's not accepted into the system, you have to take that load and get it cleaned somewhere.
Okay, so where is the cutoff as to where when you have to go get it cleaned somewhere?
Well, if it falls in below the, you know, if there's a certain, I hope you're not going to quiz me on what the numbers are. Ask me a question about contracts and arbitration. I'm an expert in that one. But if it falls outside the specifications, if there's the number of small seeds is, you know, above the limit, or the screenings, or whatever it may be, or the amount of, you know, dirt or objectionable matter or whatever, you know, if it's outside, you're just told take the truck, go and get it cleaned, come back again. And so it just won't be accepted into the system until it does comply. The only other thing I'd say there too is that it's accepted. Let's just say, and we'll use GrainCorp as an example. If GrainCorp accepted into the system and then that grain is subsequently sold and ends up with one of the other, you know, international companies shipping it, GrainCorp have to outturn it to the shipping to the exporting company's satisfaction. So they are not going to take into their system anything that's, you know, out of spec.
So how many producers typically have to go get some cleaning done before they can deliver wheat?
It's rare. It's rare.
So suffice to say that, you know, I would think it's coming off our fields as clean as it's coming off your fields, and we clean everything. So who's smart and who isn't?
We run into, I should be a politician here, we run into issues, particularly in a drought year, where you've got the comb down low, and particularly things with pulses, where there's zero tolerance for, and obviously the vast majority of the Australian pulse crop goes into the subcontinent, and I think at times they're not so much phytosanitary issues, they're trade inhibiting or trade barriers that are sort of being put up, but I know that in those sorts of times that. You can't have a sample that's got dirt in it. Well, what's the definition of dirt? You know, one speck of sand.
Pulses here run into the same issues we had. Phytosanitary issues. Is that Troy? Go ahead, sir.
Yeah, I'm just curious. There's data out there that says our single desk has an effect on our feed grain price. I'm curious, as the single desk left Australia, was there a notable effect on feed grain pricing or the livestock sector in Australia?
Not quite sure. What's the question? Was
there a notable change that you can think of in the livestock feed grain pricing or the livestock sector as a result of losing the single desk?
There wasn't, in terms of where the price landed, I'd say no. But what I would say is that there was some stock feed manufacturers, flour millers also, that used to buy their wheat from AWB, and they didn't have to have, I'm probably sounding a bit unkind here, but they didn't have to have any pricing skills. They didn't have to have any risk management skills in terms of forward pricing their grain. They knew that in 3 months' time they could go to AWB and get the grain at that particular price, whereas now they have to look out and they say, am I going to take a position out 3 months or 6 months? And the other thing about it is because AWB were the ones that they could go to, it just meant that everybody was on the same number. And that gives great comfort to a small flour miller to know that all his competitors, when it comes to what the price is, they're all going to be on the same number. So that's not a point of competition. Whereas now, they do have to compete.
Go ahead, Glenn.
Yeah, just a quick question on basis. Was anybody tracking it over time? I know you indicated that there's a bunch more new sellers and new modes there with containers and that kind of thing. So is basis levels over time?
Sorry, you're fading in.
The basis level over time, has that been tracked? You said there's
It certainly has, and I don't have those sort of numbers here. But if I can say one thing, if you went back to about 1994, or the mid-90s, you saw Australian values were typically below Chicago, whereas now they're certainly on a... It's very, very rare for Australian basis values to be below, to dip below or go into negative territory against Chicago.
But basis, just like in here, we're familiar with canola for an open market, and basis will vary from one delivery point to another quite widely, and I would assume that also happens.
No. What typically occurs is that the values, the Australian values, irrespective of whether it's wheat or barley or whatever, the calculation all goes back to what is the port value, and then let's just say to pick a site, say Brisbane, the values will be quoted. You know, what is the port price, and then we put out what are called location differentials. And that gives you a value. They are not freight rates, but they will give you what the upcountry value is. And the location differentials are published each year, so people know what they are. We put them out, and then if you deliver to a particular site, it's the Brisbane number less the location differential to that particular site. Now, the basis level comes back into the port price.
So how do companies compete for product then, if everybody's paying the same price?
Their basis levels, in an individual company's basis levels will be the same, irrespective of what the depot is.
Okay, yeah.
But the Cargill basis, the Dreyfus basis, the AWB, whoever it may be, the Glencore basis, they will all be different. And once again, the basis level will their basis levels, because their FX and their futures are going to be very, very similar, just depending on the time of day. So their point of differentiation is basis, and that goes back to how hungry they are for grain. If they want the grain, they'll push the basis.
Correct. Yes, sir.
Okay, I guess we've always been heading for a quality product to come out of Canada. Has an Australian product always been that way too, or have they gone to more what the world wants in the marketplace? Like, they tell us the American system is much less quality than ours. Are we going to be heading that way?
Okay. Yeah. I think the question was very good, but we have the impression, and we have various debates about, are we producing too much high quality? Is the market for that much high quality wheat out there? And I don't think I understand very well how our hard red spring, Canada Western red spring, lines up against, you're calling it what, Australian premium?
Yeah, APH probably, the prime hard.
Yes, yeah.
Good question. There's always this notion of a quality wheat is by definition, and I think this is an incorrect definition, is the higher premium wheats, the higher protein wheats. And yet, you know, you don't want a high protein wheat if you're making certain sorts of flours, or it's just an absolute waste if you're sticking it into an ethanol plant or some other capacity. It's fit for purpose. And so, as far as I think it's probably fair to say there has been that focus on producing the higher protein wheats, and because that's the so-called quality wheat. But one of the things that WQA will be looking at, Wheat Quality Australia, will be, because Wheat Quality Australia is not about the agronomic benefits of any particular wheat or otherwise. It is what are the traits, what are the commercial traits that the world trade, and in particular those areas where we can, as a nation, can put wheat into, what are the requirements that they need, and bringing that information back and getting that information to the breeders, so that the breeders are putting out wheats that are going to satisfy those markets where we have the advantage. Now, it may well be that instead of having a requirement for this much Australian premium hard, we only need this much, but we're much better. But you'd be much better off in another grade. So it's something that is it's a fair comment, and it's something that the organisation's looking at. And I think it's something that is now getting a lot more airplay within Australia. The other thing I would say in amongst that is that growers get very, very good market signals on exactly what you're talking about through the multi-grade contracts and the premium discount schedules accordingly, because that essentially gives them is there a sufficient spread from hard to premium hard to warrant a less yield. For instance,
are they using protein and falling numbers for criteria, or we used to use color?
I'm sorry.
one of our grading factors was color.
Yeah, look, color doesn't seem to figure. certainly protein, in a wet year, falling number comes into it, moisture, screenings are all the major things. The other thing I'd just quickly add in amongst all of that is we now have a national system, whereas when AWB were putting the standards out, there was about four what are called reference methods, and a reference method being, you know, if you're going to take grain into storage and you're going to do a protein test, this is how you'll do the protein test. We had AWB had four reference methods that were used across Australia. Since it's gone into the commercial environment, we now have 20. So it just means that if you're at Mount McLaren in central Queensland or at Kwinana, Western Australia, it goes into a storage system. We're using the same reference methods for wheat, barley and sorghum now. And so that's been a major positive for the industry. So it just means that what comes out as APH in Western Australia, APW in Western Australia, the same grain, if it's tested in New South Wales, will also be APW. So you can, with confidence, export APW out of New South Wales or Western Australia, knowing that that grain's going to suit the requirements of the end user.
Jeff, I think this is going to be the last question. We're just about to time. And just one thing. Oh, there's one more. In fact, we'll let you go because case your question is better than mine.
I just wondered if you could comment on the rail system in Australia. I realize it's not a large distance that you're dealing with, but as far as ownership or how many players
it's a problem.
Involved.
Is it all rail to port or how much comes by truck to port?
Yeah. More and more is being put onto road. With dire consequences for the road system, and that's because particularly with the branch lines are okay. Once again, it's no different in some respects to Canada. You know, we've got a nation of similar. You know, we're not quite as many, but there's about 28 million of us. But most of us are on the east coast and concentrated in the capital cities, but we've still got a huge country and trying to run the rail around that country. And what we are seeing now is the focus being put just on the main lines, but the branch lines that feed into those main lines, a lot of those branch lines are being closed down. And so if you're growing wheat and you used to deliver into a storage along any of those branch lines, some of them, their sites have remained open. But what typically is happening is the larger or the bulk handlers are closing those the sites that were on branch lines and keeping open and expanding the sites that are on the main lines. So it's been a real issue, but there's more and more being carried on road as against rail, and that's to the detriment, as a nation. And that's seen as an issue not just for grain but just for infrastructure within Australia. It's recognised that it almost needs to become a government policy to do something about the mainline, the maintenance of mainline railway within Australia.
One quick question. I was really amazed that suddenly, without a single desk seller, you're selling so much more to Asia. Asia was always close. You would think you would always have had an advantage into that marketplace. Why the difference in the difference marketing system? Why the focus now on Asia rather than the Middle East?
It's a good question. You'd have to ask somebody who was, and I'm not trying to dip it, but you'd have to ask somebody who was with AWB at the time, why there was such a strong focus on the Middle East as against the Asian markets. But certainly, it's very, very clear that since the deregulation process, the focus has really shifted to those Asian markets. And I just use, Vietnam was a very, very good example of that. Indonesia was another one.
Thanks very much to Jeff Honey.
Thanks very much, Kevin. Just in closing, whilst it'd be very, very easy to say, look, we're fierce competitors, and I don't want to sound trite when I make this comment, but in a lot of respects, it's all about growing the pie. And there's markets out there, they need to be satisfied. And the more that we can do in cahoots with, if that's the right word, with each other. And a good example of that is the leadership that's been undertaken by the Canada Grains Council with the International Grain Trade Coalition to make sure that on issues where there is commonality, whether it be phytosanitary the sustainability protocols that have been put in place in Europe, as international exporting countries, that we have a common language and a common approach. So thanks very much. I've really enjoyed it.
Really enjoyed it, Jeff. Thank you very much.